You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll find out why premium gasoline may be a waste of money for most drivers.
First, the Journal Times published a column by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, which called for the expansion of right-to-try laws. Those laws would allow terminally ill patients to receive experimental drugs that haven't been approved yet by the FDA.
Earlier this summer, Johnson authored the Trickett-Wendler Right to Try Act of 2016. The bill is yet to be approved, but last week there were hearings on the bill before the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs.
Supporters say right to try laws would give patients who are terminally ill a chance to use a drug in the early stages of development where no other alternative exists. Critics, including some medical ethicists, have said right to try creates false hope.
Alta Shero joins us now to tell us more. She's a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. Alta, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So what would this new right-to-try law do?
Not very much, and that's the sad thing. Patients are already able to get drugs that haven't been approved under the compassionate use policy at the Food and Drug Administration. And in the last 5 years, consistently, 99% of the requests have been approved, and it's taken about 4 days. In emergencies, you can get it just by a phone call. So patients are already able to get access to unapproved drugs if they are in serious condition or terminal condition, and there's no comparable treatment available that's already been approved. So these laws, they don't really change things very much except to discourage clinical trials and to keep important data out of the FDA's hands.
The compassionate use provision that you're talking about, is that the same thing as expanded access through the FDA?
Yes. Compassionate use is just a shorthand many people use, but yes, they're the same.
So I want to ask you about that 99% acceptance rate, because Senator Johnson disputed that in an opinion piece in the Journal Times here in Wisconsin, and here's a quote from this. He suggested earlier in the piece that these 99% of people who applied were, in effect, pre-approved. And the quote is, so the 99% acceptance rate doesn't account for those who are discouraged from applying because they know they're likely to be rejected.
Well, I don't know where he's getting his data from in order to dispute the data that was presented at the hearing. The Associate Commissioner for Policy, Dr. Peter Lurie, actually came in with the numbers from the last 5 years of the requests that had been made. If Senator Johnson has some way of knowing how many people out there never told the FDA they wanted to do this, it would be helpful to find out how he's doing that.
And he also raises a concern here that the FDA isn't leading the way in this. That's a quote from his piece again, by the way. He says in 2014, the FDA accepted less than 2,000 cases, and these would be these expanded access cases that you were referencing. But that same year, the equivalent program in France accepted 12,000, and France is one-fifth the population. So it is an interesting statistic. What do you think accounts for that difference?
Well, part of it may be that we actually approve drugs faster than they do in France. Last year, 60% of the new molecular entities that were approved for drugs were approved here before they were approved in Europe. And that would explain in part why it is that over there you need to have faster access to things that haven't gone through the full process. The second is that drug approval there is a more complicated process because it's part of the European Union. And so drugs can actually have gone through all of the testing and be functionally approved and yet not have completed the process. And so it's not really possible to compare the situations and be sure what kind of conclusion you can draw.
So if that's the case, if you're saying the FDA does a pretty good job of granting expanded access to some of these non-FDA-approved drugs, why are advocates and families looking for these right-to-try bills?
Well, there are two reasons. First of all, in the past, and I'm talking maybe 20, 25 years, it really was much harder to get through the bureaucracy at the FDA. I speak as somebody with personal knowledge. My closest friend from childhood was sick with Lou Gehrig's disease, and in my first 6 years here in Madison, I was running back to the East Coast to help care for her every month. And we were trying to get drugs that had not yet been approved because there's nothing for Lou Gehrig's disease. And it was complicated. But in 25 years, the FDA has changed everything. They've made it possible for manufacturers to actually recoup the cost of providing the drug because, remember, nothing obligates them to give the drug to patients. Patients have always had the right to use unapproved drugs. They just can't get them from the manufacturers. Now the manufacturers have no financial disincentive. That's been a change. And now the bureaucracy has been radically limited. So it's a single page for the application. It takes about 45 minutes for a physician to fill it out. So why are these things being promoted? I think it's part of a general ideology about personal autonomy versus the government that is cutting across many topics and not just drugs. And these bills are based on a draft piece written by the Goldwater Institute, which is dedicated to a libertarian approach to public policy. And so the same kind of language has been introduced time after time. And most people who hear about these bills, who've had no personal experience with these terrible situations, and have never had to deal with the FDA, have no idea that patients are, in fact, allowed to get these drugs. So it seems like a no-brainer. Of course you want terminally ill people to make their own decisions about the risk they'll take. So a lot of the public supports these things because they don't realize that they're unnecessary.
We're talking with Alta Sherrill right now, professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison, talking about a proposed right to try bill, which has been authored by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. And we were talking about why these bills might be picking up steam. I mean, there are 31 states that have passed right to try laws, and that's just the last 2 years. And you were suggesting maybe one of the sticking points here was the likelihood of the manufacturers, the drug manufacturers themselves, to grant access. I mean, is it possible that if there were a federal law at play, these drug manufacturers would be even more likely to hand over those drugs?
Well, it's never likely that manufacturers will hand over these drugs because they don't have enough of them. That is, you make enough for your clinical trials, and it's not a very large amount. You don't necessarily have the ability to be responding to lots of patients who want to have an individual dose or series of doses of this drug. And remember, some of these, like the new biologics, are extremely difficult and expensive to make. And it's not as simple as just multiplying a little bit your manufacturing line, making a few more, because as you try to make larger quantities of both traditional drugs and biologics, actually the whole manufacturing process has to be quite different, and it's a very expensive move to ramp up to that level. And the companies don't want to ramp up unless they know the drug ultimately is going to be approved and that they'll eventually be able to make a profit in the market.
It sounds as though this bill by Senator Ron Johnson is also limiting liability of the drug manufacturer should something not go as had already played out in trials. I mean, with that extra protection, though, would they be more likely to give these drugs?
And once again, I say it doesn't really do very much. One of the things I teach here at UW is tort law, personal liability and business liability law. So you give somebody an investigational drug that has not been approved by the FDA with all the information that is known and the information that says we can't give you any more because nobody knows. So are you going to do this at your own risk? Well, if something goes wrong, there's an automatic defense, right? These people are doing this knowingly. So the only thing that this bill might do, if it ever passed, is relieve the manufacturers of the kind of liability you don't want to relieve them from. If they have sloppy manufacturing practices and they give somebody a drug that is tainted, or they have sloppy transportation practices and the drugs are destroyed or changed in the process due to heat or cold or whatever, there you really don't want to relieve them of liability. It's the last thing you want to do.
So given all you've said, it sounds as though you're not on board with this bill, but are there other things that the FDA could do to address some of the interests and the needs that these advocates of the bill are looking for?
Well, first, I think there's one other aspect of the bill that has not been mentioned that really needs to be mentioned because it's kind of outrageous. This bill would also say that if a manufacturer gives a drug to a patient and the patient has a terrible adverse event, kills the patient, tortures the patient, that the FDA is not allowed to use that information when they're reviewing the drug and deciding whether to allow it to be sold, which means all that information that is absolutely essential is going to be hidden away, and we're going to then test this drug that kills or tortures or makes people's lives even worse on even more patients who are enrolled in clinical trials or even have it approved and sold on the market because relevant information is being hidden. So in my view, this bill actually has a provision that's positively unethical. Now, what could or should the FDA be doing? They are continuing to look for ways to streamline their process even more. Now, they may be hitting a limit in terms of how easily they can do it when 99% is approved and it's taking 4 days. Maybe they can get it to 2 days. They've got the telephone approval for emergency situations. But education of physicians about how to do this so that they don't have to start with a Google search, what do I do next, would be helpful. Physicians need to know right away, instantly, oh, this is what I do. This is how I get permission. And patient advocacy groups, that represent people who tend to have terminal illnesses with no good alternatives, people like people with Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's and Alzheimer's, those advocacy groups should also be sharing information with their members about how you do this and how you do it efficiently under the program that exists.
Alta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alta Shero. She's a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. And we were talking there about the ethics around a proposed right to try law, which was authored by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear the case for not filling up your car with premium gas unless there's a good reason to.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Fall is a short but blissful time in Wisconsin. Catherine Jago celebrates the beauty of the season before our retreat into winter.
On my early morning walk, I see streams of people on bikes and in cars, rushing places with their backpacks and briefcases. All that industry and purpose, just when the vegetable world is finally done with its own urgency and lolling around, sluggish in the sultry heat, at a lull, a pendulum pausing before it gathers momentum. The nests have been built, filled, and emptied. The chicks hatched, fledged, and flown. Flowers have budded, bloomed, and been pollinated. Seeds have been formed and released. Ears of corn have swelled behind their silks, and worms have eaten the tips. Jewelweed looms over the bike path near the lake, huge and overgrown, shrinking the trail almost to a tunnel. The trees are so full and laden with leaves, they look like ships of the line. Such volumes of living, photosynthesizing tissue. A mature leafy tree produces as much oxygen over the summer as 10 people inhale in a year. But their green color is tired. They're a darker shade now. Many of the maple leaves are blemished with black spots ringed with yellow, which remind me of puncture repair patches for bicycles. Things have heavy heads. The pear trees are laden with green fruit, some of it littering the ground. In the neighboring yards, there are tomato plants drooping under their reddening globes and ovals, their leaves bedraggled, drained of color, flagging with the effort of reproducing, the last of the blazing marigolds and giant zinnias. In our own front yard, there are huge cream hydrangea heads, so heavy and lush with panicles that they threaten to break the branches. The shrub itself has grown enormous, reaching to the top of the living room window. The walnut tree is firing off great lime-green missiles that sound like gunshots when released and thud to the earth for the squirrels and chipmunks to gnaw on, leaving dark brown debris that stains our deck, clothes, skin. The outdoor pools have closed for the season, but I am still stained with my swimmer's tan, panda eyes where my goggles were, and a stripe of milky forehead below my hairline, left by my cap. When I can no longer swim outdoors, I feel a great sense of loss. Walking home, I realize the colors of fall wildflowers in Wisconsin are yellow, purple, and white. Yellow for goldenrod, sunflowers, black-eyed Susans, mullein, sneezeweed. Purple for asters and knapweed. White for snakeroot, boneset, yarrow, and Queen Anne's lace. The yellow, purple, and white flag belongs to the city of Kyoto, which Japanese poet Basho described as a place so lovely, we long for it even while we are there. Like this fall morning in Wisconsin, shining in the face of the oncoming cold and dark.
Catherine Jago is a translator, writer, and poet. Her most recent book is News from the North. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And speaking of fall colors, maybe you're planning on hopping in the car and taking a trip somewhere in the state to soak them in. But when you pull into the gas station to fuel up for that trip, what kind of gas are you putting in your car?
More likely than not, a tank of regular unleaded works just fine for you. But every now and then, maybe you're tempted to fuel up with the premium stuff. After all, it's got to be better for our cars, right?
Well, not so fast, says AAA. According to the group's new study, putting premium gas into cars designed to run on regular fuel provides no additional benefits to that vehicle.
Here with us to talk more about the study and what it means for you is Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, Nick, I don't get the more expensive stuff because I'm cheap, but I often feel a little guilty, like, maybe my car needs better stuff. You're saying probably not, right?
That's correct. You know, there's a common perception, you know, just based on the terminology that they use, that the premium gas is somehow better gas. And that's really not the case. It's simply different. It has a higher octane level, and certain engines, either in high-performance vehicles or in some luxury vehicles, do need that extra octane. But unless your vehicle does require that extra octane, using it provides no extra benefit to you. And given the cost difference, it's really a waste of money.
Yeah, how much are American drivers, you're saying, wasting on this fuel?
Oh, well, the average difference between regular and premium is about 50 cents per gallon. So when we added up, we found that about 16.5 million Americans are using premium gasoline in the vehicles that don't call for it, at least occasionally, on average about once a month. And when you add that all up, that's about a $2.1 billion waste of money by Americans in the last year, in the last 12 months, on this extra octane gasoline they don't need.
Now, AAA researchers, I understand, didn't just take this on faith. They actually put it to the test. What kind of experiments happened at AAA to try to see if maybe those ordinary cars would get a benefit from premium gas?
Well, what we did is we took several different vehicles that are very common vehicles that we think are representative of certain classes of vehicles, as sedans, SUVs, put them on what's called a dyno, which is kind of basically a treadmill for a car that lets you run the engine, run the vehicle as if you were driving it, and, you know, put some regular gas in it, did some driving with it, did a number of different tests to specifically looking at engine performance, engine output in terms of carbon output, and then also the cleanliness of the engine. Did it leave more or less deposits in the engine after using that gas, and compared the premium to the regular, and found that there really was no benefit to it. So there was no increased horsepower or performance by the engine. There was no increased fuel efficiency or reduction in carbon output, and there were no less deposits in the engine, so your engine wasn't any cleaner because you used the premium gasoline.
So some kind of cars, a minority of vehicles, do need a higher grade of gasoline, a higher octane, I should say, gasoline. For consumers out there, how will they know if they have that kind of car?
What you want to do is go by what is in your vehicle manual. So when you buy the car, you know, look in the glove box, there's your owner's manual right in there. It will tell you very clearly what kind of gas you need. And it may use the terms premium or regular, or more likely, it'll give you a specific octane rating that is the minimum octane rating necessary. And the reason it does that is because in certain parts of the country, and even what I found is that in certain parts of Wisconsin, particularly up in the northern, northwest part of the state, the octane ratings are slightly different. So in most places, it's 87 octane is regular and 93 octane is premium, although that does vary a little bit around the country. But so what you want to do is just check what is the minimum octane rating necessary for your vehicle, and just make sure that you're not using anything more than that.
And I understand previous AAA research found that fuel quality can vary significantly among gasoline retailers. How do we know which gas station offers the best stuff?
Well, there's a program called Top Tier, which is an independent certification program that the stations and the oil companies can voluntarily put their gas through. And that does look specifically at detergents and to see what are cleaner burning fuels, what's going to leave fewer deposits in your engine. And most major gas retailers, like specifically here in Wisconsin, Quick Trip, BP, Shell, Costco, there's actually a whole list. If you go to the website for the top tier certification, it can tell you which brands utilize this. But most of the brands also will advertise this on their pumps now. If they do earn that certification from top tier, they tend to advertise it. And that's a way to know that the gas you're buying is of a higher quality and is better for your engine. Sometimes it does cost a little more, certainly not more than premium costs. You're talking maybe about a 5 cent difference versus a 50 cent difference for the higher octane. But that's certainly a much better use of your money to look for that top tier. And then, if you really want to treat your car, make sure that you're taking the best care of it, spend that money on getting more frequent oil changes. Make sure that you're keeping up on your preventative maintenance, the schedule of fluid flushes and things like that that's recommended by your manufacturer. That's what's going to really help keep your engine running as long as possible.
We'll leave it there. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about why premium gasoline is, for most car owners, not all it's cracked up to be.
Coming up, a new study shows that just 3% of Americans own nearly half of the guns in the country. We look at the political and the cultural implications. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 7, join Glenn Washington for Snap Judgment, this week's edition featuring top storytellers recorded at a live event in Los Angeles. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, a new survey by Harvard and Northeastern Universities has produced an unusually detailed picture of gun ownership in the United States. The overall trends, the number of gun owners has declined, gone down, but the number of guns has increased sharply. The report says that America's gun stock has increased by 70 million guns since 1994.
Christopher Ingraham joins us now to talk about that study and what it may mean for us as a nation. He writes about politics, drug policy, and data for The Washington Post, and his article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are the broad strokes from this new survey?
Well, the really interesting thing here, and this has been a central paradox of American gun ownership for a long time, is that household surveys have shown for probably 2 decades now that the percent of either individual adults or of households overall who actually own guns, that percentage is declining. On the other hand, if we look at FBI background check data, that shows us that the number of guns that are being purchased on a monthly basis is just skyrocketing, and particularly that's been happening during the Obama administration. So there's a real paradox there, and I think the implication that this study really shines a bright light on is that much of that seems to be driven not on more individuals or more households purchasing their first guns, but on gun owners and on many gun owners stocking up on their 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and beyond guns. So there's a real interesting picture here of the concentration of American gun ownership. What the study found was that just 3% of American adults own roughly 50% of the nation's 265 or 300 million or so guns.
It's an interesting trend. The Guardian newspaper referred to that 3% as super owners, saying that they do own multiple guns, an average of 17 guns each. What do we know about who these individuals are?
Well, there's a you know, there are a lot of different reasons. And if you talk to a lot of gun owners, you know, people who don't own guns might look at these numbers and think, 17 guns, oh, my God, these people must all be stocking up for the apocalypse or something. But if you talk to, you know, gun owners, folks who do own that, they're like, yeah, you know what, that seems like a reasonable number. There are many different reasons. A lot of folks are collectors. They really like historic and historically significant firearms, and they just kind of collect them along the years. For other folks, it just, you know, it just seems it's not anything that they consciously do. It's just kind of happened the way, you know, a person might acquire shoes or video games or movies. They just, you know, they're into guns, and they just happen to pick up a gun here and a gun here and there, and after 20 years, you've got, you know, 17, 18, 19 guns. So there's a lot of different reasons. I think that, you know, that the easy stereotype to go to is that these people are all kind of, you know, paranoid and looking to stop up on guns and ammunition in order to, you know, stay off the end of the world or some kind of terrible apocalyptic scenario. And that certainly may be the case for some folks, but there's a real diversity in reasons for why people own guns. And this is just at the very top end among this 3%. When you look at the broader universe of gun owners, the other, you know, 22% of the public who own the rest of the guns, you know, they have many different reasons for doing so as well.
Is that 22%, or is the purchase number going up there as well, or is it mostly just in this 3%?
Sure. So that is tough to say. This survey doesn't necessarily shine a light on that. What we can say is that, you know, various survey outfits, they ask people about gun ownership over time, and different surveys, and this is a real kind of puzzle for gun research, because different surveys show different percentages of people owning guns. This survey actually showed a relatively low percentage of American adults who say they personally own a firearm. If you look at some other research by places like the Pew Research Center or by Gallup, they show that roughly 28% or 31% of individuals own guns. So this survey came in a little bit lower on the total number of people who own guns. But all of the surveys do generally show either a flattening out of the overall trends in ownership or a decline, and in some cases a steep decline in some of the other surveys. And the kind of sometimes severe differences between these surveys, that's a real puzzle for social science researchers. So there's been a lot of questioning around, you know, how these studies are showing different percentages, you know, whether the share of Americans owning guns is actually decreasing, whether there's just a greater reluctance on the part of gun owners to admit to researchers that they actually do own guns. There are a lot of questions here, but this is one of the larger surveys that's been done. It's certainly been one of the more comprehensive in terms of the questions that it's asked. And so a lot of researchers are really excited by these findings. They're saying that it's painting a much clearer picture of American gun ownership than they ever had before.
As you mentioned, I mean, I guess one question is, how accurate is this? I would imagine that some gun owners might not want to talk to a random survey person about the number of guns that they own or why they own them. I mean, how accurate do we think these numbers are?
Yeah, so that's kind of a big question. And when you hear gun rights advocates, whenever a survey like this come out, they tend to criticize these surveys on precisely the same grounds. They say, look, I wouldn't tell a random caller about guns in my house, and nobody who I don't know who owns guns would do the same. And that's kind of a common criticism. A couple things do speak out in favor of this survey. The first is that it wasn't a random direct dial survey. The folks who were being interviewed, they weren't talking to actual people. They were filling out survey forms completely anonymously online. There was no human being at the other end of it. And so there might be a greater likelihood of respondents to be more honest when they're just talking to a computer as opposed to when they're talking to an actual human being. But the other thing that makes people feel relatively good about these studies is that researchers have actually tried to look into it. They've actually tried to find out if people really do underreport their gun ownership. So they've done a survey of, say, a metropolitan area, and they've surveyed, you know, to try to find out what percent of the people say they own guns. And then in some cases, they're able to look at gun registration numbers in those areas to see if those numbers line up. And what they generally find is, in a lot of cases, they do. So it doesn't look like there's too much underreporting here. I mean, if you talk to gun owners, many of them are proud of the fact that they own guns, and they want to, they want people to know that, and they want people to understand that, you know, owning a gun is just a normal American thing to do, and they kind of want to speak out for their hobby and their pastime. So there's not a whole lot of evidence that there is underreporting, and the particular design of this survey, it was designed in mind with keeping underreporting to a minimum.
We're talking right now with Christopher Ingram about a new study that takes a look at guns and gun ownership in the United States. And Christopher Ingram writes for The Washington Post. And another, maybe this is a surprise, I'm not so sure, actually, the number of women who are buying guns, that's also increasing. What do we know about that?
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting reasons for that. And certainly groups like the National Rifle Association, they have been really emphatic about, you know, pushing the idea that, you know, women are buying guns too. And for many women, it's a self-defense question. Many women are just getting into sports like hunting and target shooting. So there is a fair amount of diversity among people who own guns. On the other hand, when you look at the averages of the numbers, you know, the demographics of American gun owners kind of look like what you might expect to. They're generally male. They're generally white. They generally they're more likely to live in rural areas than they are to, say, in, say, big cities or whatever. So there's, to some extent, to which the stereotype of the typical gun owner is true, but the survey does show that there's actually a surprising amount of diversity. And I think among women, you see a lot of women talking about self-protection and self-defense as one of the primary reasons that they own a gun. And overall, among the whole public, what's really interesting is that self-defense has become a really important factor that people give as to why they own guns. 15, 16 years ago, a majority of people said they owned guns because they wanted to hunt or they wanted to target shoot. Now the majority say that they own it for self-defense, and hunting and target shooting have kind of fallen along the wayside.
You say self-defense. Other advocates of gun ownership and critics also have said that this looks to them more like fear, that this is a reaction of a fearful society.
Yeah, well, that's something really interesting. What we know about, you know, if you look at overall crime rates in the U.S., in both cities and in rural areas, crime is just at close to near historic levels. The murder rate has fallen precipitously since the early 90s. On the other hand, if you ask people, people say that they don't feel safer than they did 10 or 15 years ago. So there's a real disconnect between how things are actually happening in society and what the actual on-the-ground truth is when it comes to, you know, violence and violent crime, and how people feel about that. And so that disconnect is partly driving a lot of the reason for a lot of these folks to own and purchase guns, and to either go out and purchase their first gun or to go out and purchase 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 in order to, you know, prepare for perhaps the worst case scenario.
Chris Ingram is with us now from the Washington Post, talking about a new study that takes a look at guns and gun ownership in the United States.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you own 0 guns, 1 gun, 17 guns, as some do? Why have you made that decision? And what do you think of the political clout of gun owners? Hearing the numbers, do you think they have too much say, not enough say in American politics? Does this issue influence who you vote for one way or another at a state or national level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation now about a new study that shows that while there are more guns in America, they're owned by fewer people. Christopher Ingram stays with us. He's written about that study for The Washington Post.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your attitudes toward gun ownership? Do you own guns yourself? If you're willing to share that information with us, why do you own them? How many? Or why do you not? And what do you think about guns and politics? Is this an issue that you vote on? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Troy on the line with us in DeForest. Hi, Troy.
Hi there. Yeah, I have 17 guns. The reason I own them is because it's my constitutional right. I also own them to protect my family and my friends, and I just feel like it's a good thing to have. And it definitely does influence who I'm voting for this November.
And Troy, let me ask you, are these guns that you have bought recently in the past year, or is this the accumulated buying of over the years?
It started as just for hunting, and then as I got older, it started to be more shooting and assault rifle type stuff. So, I mean, it's just a good hobby to have. It's a good family-oriented hobby, and, I mean, my whole family does it. It's just a great pastime.
All right, Troy, thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing that with us. Troy falling squarely into the camp you were talking about. He is in, it sounds like, that 3% of gun owners who own a majority of guns. He owns 17, which is the average. And it sounds like this is something he's been doing for a long time.
Yeah, Troy can he can sleep well knowing that he is one of the elite 3% of America's top gun owners. And he does in many ways. It sounds very emblematic of the trends in this survey. He started for hunting. He just started picking them up. And it was interesting what he said about, you know, the primary thing he cited was that he owns guns because it's his constitutional right to do so. And if you look at some other surveys, you kind of see this trend where people say, well, I own guns because the Second Amendment says that I have the right to do that. So that idea of individual rights and individual liberty, that's a really powerful force, I think, for many gun owners. And so many do cite that Second Amendment protection as, you know, they both cite the protection it gives them, and they cite their gun ownership as a defense of that Second Amendment.
Troy, thanks a lot. And we're going to go next to Molly in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I wanted to tell you that I don't have a gun. Our family's never had one. I have grandchildren now. I've had children. As a child, I would have found a gun playing at somebody's house. And I think it's an irresponsible thing to have if for fear factors. Hunting, target shooting, a gun is fine. I would like to see people register them at a gun club or their skeet shooting club. But we have 911. We have a law enforcement system. And I don't think we should be taking our personal defense into our own hands.
And this is an issue you'll vote on?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Molly. Appreciate that. Christopher, any thoughts on Molly's call?
Yeah, she brings up a really interesting point about self-defense and law enforcement. And, you know, many folks are uneasy with this kind of rise in people saying that they're owning guns for self-defense. And the worry is that that might lead to more people taking the law into their own hands. And that can, you know, as we've seen from a lot of high-profile instances in the past years, that can have sometimes fatal consequences. So, you know, along with owning a gun for self-defense, that brings an extra onus of responsibility for, you know, knowing when to use lethal force in self-defense and, you know, when a situation requires and it justifies lethal force on the gun owner's behalf and when it doesn't. And given the wide variety of laws in different states and the sometimes very gray areas in the laws in terms of protections for both gun owners and for, in some cases, for people who confront gun owners and for criminals who confront gun owners, it can be a really thorny issue to navigate. So that we've seen that kind of spring up over and over again. And as I suspect, as more people owning guns for self-defense, I suspect we'll continue to see more of that.
All right, Molly, thank you so much for that call. And another call here from Tracy in Upper Michigan. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling. I'm ex-military. I grew up with weapons. The first time I fired one, I was like 7. We've always used it for hunting, but I live way out in the county. Takes law enforcement a half an hour to get there. So we have it for hunting as well as for protection. Our weapons are registered, but I also believe it's our Second Amendment right, and there's no reason to make it political. They need to leave our Constitution alone.
Tracy, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate that. And Tracy echoes another facet of the study that people who are or served in the military are likely to be gun owners.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. When you look at the demographics, the people who have served in the military are the most likely. It shows that 44% of military veterans currently own a firearm. And the caller also mentioned another important factor in gun ownership, and that's whether or not you grew up with a gun. People who did grow up with guns in the household, 35% of them own guns today. On the other hand, people who did not grow up with guns, only 9% of them own guns today. So it's partially a family and cultural issue. And she raised another really good issue of rural areas. And, you know, I just talked about law enforcement in city areas when you already have police forces kind of on the beat and doing the job. When you live out in the country, when you live in a rural area, she's absolutely right that in some cases it can take the police 30, 45 minutes, sometimes hours to get to you if you run into a sticky situation. And in those cases, many owners feel compelled to purchase a gun just for their own safety.
We leave it there. Christopher, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Happy to do it.
That was Christopher Ingram. He writes about politics, drug policy, and data for The Washington Post. And his article looking at a new survey on guns and gun ownership is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
candidates in this year's Wisconsin Senate race say they're keeping an eye out for federal court arguments on President Obama's main effort to combat climate change. Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold disagree over the president's clean power plan, and that's just the beginning of the differences between the two candidates on environmental policy. Chuck Kornbach has this story on the green feud in the Senate contest.
When environmental groups spend money on ad buys in the Senate races, the cost is usually too high to stay in for long. But the League of Conservation Voters Victory Fund was a persistent spender this summer, taking on Republican incumbent Johnson. Here, Johnson is blasted as being out of touch on climate change.
NASA, the Department of Defense, and 97% of scientists agree climate change is real. So where can you find climate change science deniers? At oil companies and Senator Ron Johnson's office.
The ad shows a 2010 interview in which Johnson says he doesn't think the science of human-caused climate change is proven. But these days, to reporters anyway, the senator doesn't attack climate science as much as he does the Obama administration's effort to go after a key emitter of greenhouse gases, coal-fired power plants. Johnson says he hopes the federal court decides the president went too far with the clean power plan.
If you want to enact something like that, you should do it through Congress, pass a law, not, again, have this enormous regulatory and executive overreach.
Johnson contends that if utilities have to spend more on cleaning their coal boilers or if using more alternative energy is expensive, Wisconsin's economy would suffer. Democratic Senate candidate Russ Feingold supports the clean power plan. He calls it an opportunity for the state.
This is a flexible rule. It allows each state to come up with their own plan. Of course, unfortunately, Governor Walker and Ron Johnson don't want to do that, but you can come up with your own plan based on your state's needs.
Feingold hopes Wisconsin would make more use of solar, wind, and other cleaner energy sources and less of coal. The former senator is also attacking Johnson on some water issues.
Please join me in welcoming Senator Russ Feingold.
At the Wisconsin Counties Association meeting in Milwaukee, Feingold urged collaboration between local, state, and national agencies on environmental topics, like getting a community safe drinking water.
When Senator Johnson was asked about the problem in Kewaunee County about the wells, he said, what we need there is to grow business and less regulation. Look, that's not an answer.
Johnson says he does want collaboration, but with efforts more led by the state of Wisconsin.
I really do, because I've been involved at a local level. I've got faith in local officials, county, state, coming together. You know, we all want a clean environment. We certainly want a clean environment throughout Wisconsin. We've got a very strong DNR. You know, rather than have the federal government impose solutions.
The Johnson-Feingold contest is getting national attention as part of Democrats' attempts to regain control of the U.S. Senate. Former Obama administration energy advisor Heather Zeichel says if Johnson wins and the GOP keeps the majority, there will be more politics.
Looking at some of the chairmen of the specific committees, you're going to continue to see some of the witch hunts about what happened in, you know, the EPA administrator's Twitter account, or did she talk to somebody on her personal cell phone, or, you know, who did they talk to at the Sierra Club to finalize this regulation on methane emissions?
But James Conanton, an environmental official under President George W. Bush, says a lot will depend on what part of the nation has the most clout in January.
I don't think it's as easy as splitting outcomes on partisan lines, because at the end of the day, these energy and environmental issues actually split on regional lines.
Libertarian Phil Anderson is also running in the Wisconsin Senate race. He advocates a strong free market approach with low taxes and a low regulatory burden. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.